I'm Peter Medlin, and you are listening to Teacher's Lounge. And if this is your first time hearing our show, I've got really good news for you. This is based on a really simple idea that we've all had teachers in our lives who helped us become who we are today. And every educator we have on this podcast, whether teacher, coach, or professor, is nominated by the folks who listen. We want you to be a part of the show with us. So please tell us about the educators who've inspired you and the folks in your community who you think deserve a spotlight. You can email us with your nominations at teachersLounge@niu.edu. And today on Teacher's Lounge, it is my conversation with Bob Chicos. He's a special education teacher at Crystal Lake Central High School in Crystal Lake, Illinois. And in that role, he gets to teach a little bit of everything from math to English. And like most special ed teachers, he has the advantage of getting to know students and their families over the course of multiple years and multiple classes. Now, Bob's also involved in education policy work at the state level with Teach Plus and Advance Illinois, where he worked on reports about the teacher pipeline and school psychologist shortages. And at the end of our conversation, we talk about Bob's very interesting recent adventure that took him all the way around Illinois. We've got that coming up, but first, we've got another education story we want to share. It has been a stressful year for many international students. The Trump administration's canceling visas, rewriting rules, and monitoring students' social media. And I got to sit down with a Northern Illinois University student from Nigeria to talk about life on a visa. In the fall of 2023, the semester was in full swing, the weather was getting cold, and Babatola Arugundade was more stressed than ever.
I was missing home, I was struggling with food, then the weather became cold, I was struggling with the weather.
He thought about quitting. Mental health struggles are common for international students, and to make matters worse, Tola came to the U.S. to study mental health. He's a doctoral student at NIU's Counselor Education and Supervision Program. Tola wanted to study in the U.S. to build bridges, to connect Western counseling theories and techniques with African psychological principles, but all he could do that fall was keep his head above water. It was his first time in the U.S., and it was a grueling visa process just to get here.
You know, you go to an embassy in Nigeria, U.S. embassy, and you see over 5,000 people there applying for visa. How many are going to get approved? Maybe 100.
But he says the challenges start way before you enter the embassy. First, you have to apply to a school, interview, and get accepted.
Then, not all admission comes with full funding.
Can you pay tuition and fees? It's especially tough when over 60% of Nigerians are multidimensionally poor, meaning they experience poverty across several indicators like health and living conditions. And Tola was accepted at NIU, but he says he was initially only offered a 10-hour per week graduate assistantship, even though he was eligible for 20 hours. And without a full scholarship, he had to raise nearly $20,000 to prove to the embassy he could pay for college.
I started soliciting for money to borrow from different families, different friends, to ensure I have the sufficient amount. It wasn't easy.
It took 2 months, and then he had to secure an interview at the embassy.
But in Nigeria, it's more like a sport. It's like a competition.
He created a WhatsApp group with other students, taking turns watching the website day and night in case an open appointment pops up. It can take days or weeks, and Tola didn't have much time.
We are kind of religious back home, so people pray.
Finally, a date came up, July 5th, and he got it. And in the meantime, he got even more good news. The university could now offer the full 20-hour graduate assistantship, and that means he didn't need to borrow as much money, and that raised his approval odds. But now he also had to update key documents, and it took days of calls and emails, and he got it just in time for his interview.
I was scared. It's between either yes or no. And interview at the consular is less than a minute. It's not as if they interview you for 30 minutes. It's less than a minute.
Why are you studying in the U.S.? How are you paying for school? He rehearsed his answers because he knew just one stutter could cost him. And thankfully, he was confident. He says he saw the interviewer reach for the white approval paper as he answered, and it was a massive relief. But now he only had a few weeks to get a passport, book a flight, find an apartment in DeKalb, and say goodbye to his family.
So I left Nigeria July 30. Then I entered 31st. Then I resumed work August 1st. So there was like no rest for me.
A few months in, he was exhausted. He thought about transferring or quitting. International students are held to a high standard. GPA minimums, full class loads, only working in jobs related to your field. It's difficult, especially as you're adjusting to a new school and a new country. And his first semester seeing clients in the U.S. showed him how hard it would be to build bridges between Western and African approaches.
I remember when my supervisor at the place came and talk to my professor here about the kind of approach I'm using, more like as if I'm not competent enough. Then I remember them calling me at my department, trying to talk about, what kind of struggle am I going through. That period, I think I felt a bit betrayed.
He says he'd always get assigned black clients, and there was a misconception that because he's black, that they had the same experiences, even though he's not African-American, he's African.
The first year was really, really tough, and it ignited my research.
That project was understanding the supervision experience of black counselors with multiple minority identities. You can be black and an international student, or black and disabled. And Tola says all of those identities intersect and should be acknowledged in supervision. And he earned a grant to fund that research in 2024. And Tola says he found his participants were forced to do a lot of extra labor.
Over explaining to their supervisor about their identity and also try to protect themselves from their supervisor, and also protecting their client from their supervisor, because once you can't trust your supervisor regarding certain things, you want to protect your client.
He's now expanding that research for his dissertation and expanding beyond just black counselors to all counselors with multiple minority identities. And Tola also recently received an award from the Illinois Counselor Educators and Supervisors Organization. And while he's personally settled in at NIU over the past 2 years, life on a student visa has become more and more challenging. This year, the Trump administration revoked, then reinstated scores of student visas across the country, including several at NIU. And the administration said it would review all 55 million visa holders for potential violations, and they're also vetting social media accounts. All that led to international enrollment falling 20% at NIU this fall. Provost Lori Ellis Piper said some students were unable to get their visas in time to start the semester, and more visas are now subject to additional review called administrative processing, which can take months. And Tola says he knows several international students with full-ride scholarships who were denied after administrative processing.
They don't tell you why you had been denied. That is the frustrating part. So you don't know, maybe you have put something on your social media 10 years ago. You don't know.
Even if you're approved, processing delays could cost you a spot in a program or a GA position. Rule changes have also affected Tola personally. His initial visa was for 2 years.
Most African countries, they don't give 2 years visa anymore. Let me use my country as a case study. Now they give 3 months visa.
The new short visas also only allow a single entry. So if you leave the country, whether for vacation or university research, it invalidates your visa and you have to start all over. And with all of those new changes, he wonders if he could have even made it to NIU if he was going through that process now.
I don't think I would have that luck.
He says it makes him sad because he sees how much international students contribute to their schools and the economy. Tola knows a lot of students who live in fear that their visas could get ripped away at any moment.
I don't live with fear. That's the only way. I'm not just on that surviving mode. I'm in the living mode. Life comes at us very fast. Policies will come. I try to still stay optimistic.
He hopes to graduate within a year and eventually return to Nigeria to keep building bridges between cultures and break down the barriers that keep people from getting the help they need. All right, now it's time for my conversation with Crystal Lake special ed teacher Bob Chicos. And I started off by asking him to share a great moment he's had with a student recently.
So actually today, I had a student, and she started the year saying math's her least favorite. I said, well, I'm gonna change you, you're gonna like math. And she's, no, I hate math. Well, today, I also have her for a study hall class.
Yeah.
And she came out to me and she said she found like an extra worksheet that she was using as scratch paper, but she flipped it over and she just started doing math problems from the last unit just for fun. And then she showed me, she's like, I did it just for fun. I'm like, see, I changed you. Now you like math, don't you? That was pretty cool.
That was fast. I'm sure you get that all the time though, right? Like math is kind of the class that people really want to tell you how much they don't like it while you're teaching it.
Yeah, exactly. I think a lot of the problem is we push people in math, and math keeps progressing and progressing and building on each other. And at any point in there, if you stumble, it's really hard to get caught up. Math was my favorite subject when I was in third grade, fourth grade. And then somewhere between there and high school, somewhere in the middle there, I hated it. And I think it was because somewhere along the way, I started daydreaming or something, and I could never catch up to that cycle. So a lot of people, adults say, I'm bad at math. You might not be bad at math. I think you could just been introduced to something when you weren't ready for it. But I took math classes in college doing the same things that I couldn't do before. And I told myself I can't do that kind of math. But when it was presented in a different way by a college teacher, I'm like, oh, I get it now. I got pretty excited about that.
I feel like a lot of us have that. Like, I feel like math being something that is a subject that people don't like, I feel like that's, and again, maybe this is just pure conjecture, maybe this is just my own experience talking, but I feel like you don't hear that as much at the really early grade levels, right? Like at first and second grade, I feel like, again, when we're building up some of those foundations, once we start to build on those and expand out, and sometimes we lose people at certain points in that process, is when you start getting more and more of students being like, math isn't for me, or I'm not good at math. But I do feel like it is something that, like a lot of you were saying, like your experience when you're younger, and I feel like I had this too, where math was something that I enjoyed, and then somewhere along the line I got bronchitis for a week and never caught up, you know. It's, I mean, but math, I want to be clear on this too. You wear a lot of hats. Math is not the only thing that you do as a teacher, correct?
Right. I've taught a lot of subjects. So I used to work with the population of kids. It's called lower incidence, the kids who have more significant disabilities. And when I worked with them, I taught science, social studies, math, like everything. I transitioned more to working with kids who have learning disabilities. And now, so I teach primarily math, but I also teach an English class right now. Some of the kids I've had actually for 3 years now, some of the kids, I they're my senior English class. I've had them freshman year in math. I had them sophomore year in English, and I'm having them now in senior English.
When it comes to high school English or high school math teaching, that's not something that happens very often.
No, especially not in the larger schools. Sometimes in the smaller schools, you can have teachers several times.
Right, for sure. And so you still, in your current role, are you still working through kind of IEP and 504 processes?
Oh, yeah, quite a bit. Some districts do it differently where they have one staff member who's dedicated only to writing IEPs and that paperwork, and then the special ed teachers just teach. Our district still does it where we teach and have case management paperwork. I think it's better that way because when you're writing the IEPs, if you have the student as a student in your class, you get to know them really well and you build that relationship and you get to know the nuances. So when you're doing things like writing goals, it's based on how well you know them. You get to know them very well when you see them every single day.
Right, especially if you have them for multiple years in a row, which over the years of interviewing people who work in special education, that is kind of one of the core advantages of that, is that you get students for multiple years, you get to know the families a little bit, and right, like you get to be involved with writing those goals and everything, which is good that you get to be like an intimate part of that process too.
Right.
Yeah. And I, you know, I think it's something that, even though all of us, you know, go through education at least K through 12, right, like there's still very few people who have experience in special education or feel like they understand it. I think it's a blind spot that a lot of people, just because they, you know, maybe don't have the personal experience with it, or maybe didn't have anyone in their family that dealt with it or anything like that. And so it was something that I realized a couple of years ago, I felt like was a big blind spot for me, and I knew for a lot of other people too. And so I took on this project to kind of help write a guide for IEPs and 504 plans for parents who are also maybe coming into this process and just like need somewhere where you can define all the terms and, you know, really get in the basics. And it was such a learning experience for me. I'm curious, for you, is it something that you had experience with going in? Like, how did you get into special education in the first place?
So when I was in high school, I was a good kid, but not a good student. And I didn't really know what I wanted to do with my life. I definitely wasn't going to any Ivy League school or anything. I thought I might want to get into TV production. And then going into my senior year, I learned that there was an opportunity to be a student helper in a PE class with kids with disabilities. I thought,
what grade were the kids? Like,
so they were in high school.
Okay.
So it was integrated class. So there were kids with intellectual disabilities, grades 9 through 12. So they were my peers, but we never really saw these kids because they were in their own classroom throughout the day, and we were in our classrooms. So I heard about this opportunity, and I signed up for it, and they accepted me into the program. Even though my grades were pretty bad, it usually seems like all the perks go to the kids with the good grades. But they accepted me, and I loved it. I would go in, and when my peers were skipping school because they were seniors, I'm like, I can't skip school. These kids need me. We had several female volunteers, but we had only two male volunteers. So if I skipped, and let's say the other boys skipped, there'd be like nobody to help out in the locker room, like nobody to help out. So I really felt this responsibility. It really helped me grow. We had a student teacher. I still remember his name was Mr. Pedraza. And I looked him up. He's still a teacher. He's a teacher in Lake Zurich. And he pulled me aside one day, and he's like, you're really good with these kids. I'm like, oh, thanks. And he said, have you thought about becoming a special ed teacher? And I was like, no, I can't be a special ed teacher. He like, I thought, I'm a bad student. I couldn't be a special ed teacher.
Right, how could I be a teacher if I don't feel like I'm a good student?
Exactly. And he's like, no, you're really good with these kids. I think you really found your niche in life, you know? I didn't go into special ed right away, but he planted that seed in my head. And I got a degree in history, and having a degree in, you know, a liberal arts degree isn't usually the most attractive to employers. So this was 1996 when I graduated, and the internet was just coming into play, and some places were accepting applications online. Some did the old, you know, right, paper thing.
Hand in the and piece of paper.
I found it very hard to find a job. It's months looking for a job. And in that time, I thought about, well, what do I really value in life? What do I really like? And I thought that class, I just love that class. So there was a facility for adults with disabilities in the next town, and I applied to work there, and they had an opening in their recreation department. I liked it. It was like what I was doing in high school. I was working with the people with disabilities, but they were older. They were all adults. I was there for 11 years, and I loved it so much. And I just wanted to go further with my career. So I went back to school to get certified in special ed, and I've been teaching at the high school ever since.
That's fascinating. And you didn't even necessarily, when you went back to become a special ed teacher in the classroom, in the school system, did you start off thinking that you were going to do it same thing in recreation and PE, or had that seed that was originally planted combined with those, you know, previous seeds of taking math courses in college and things like that? Because I'm curious about that.
I didn't go back thinking I was going to be a physical ed teacher working with kids with special needs, because that's usually a role within the PE teacher's domain, where they're a PE teacher and they may have an adaptive certification to work with the kids. I just thought I was going to go into the classroom to be a teacher. The thing about math is I didn't think I was going to be teaching math. I'll be a special ed teacher, and I was assigned to do a lot of math, and pretty much my whole career they've been having me do math, maybe because I'm the, you know, I'm not going to complain about it. About 5 or 6 years ago, they assigned me to co-teach algebra, and I'm thinking, I haven't had algebra since I was a freshman in high school. My co-teacher is great because I would be with them, and I would like almost learn along with the kids to try to bring it back. And I'm like, oh, I get this now that I'm, you know, older in life, I get it. But what was cool about that was, since I was kind of relearning it, when the kids were struggling, I was understanding why they were struggling, you know, as opposed to somebody who it's so natural to them that they can't really understand why somebody else isn't getting it.
I mentioned how I felt like I needed to much better understand what the special education process and IEPs and 504s, how that worked as an education reporter. And that I know it's something that can be a blind spot for some parents that are getting into it new. I'm curious for you, as just a teacher where you're in a school with lots of other teachers who are doing lots of other things, do you feel like most other teachers who aren't working with those populations, aren't working with IEPs and 504s, do you feel like most people kind of understand how that works, or is it also something that sometimes you might have to be like, okay, well, you know, kind of to explain a little bit how this works, because it's kind of its own complicated process?
I'm actually really amazed at how like informed our teachers are in my school.
Yeah,
they're really good, and I when I use my language, this accommodation, that they know what I'm talking about, because the kids with IEPs, they're in all the classes. We have kids in my direct classes where it's, you know, everyone has an IEP, and they're in AP and honors classes. They're all over. So the teachers, like I say, are pretty good at really understanding our language.
Right. Everyone has to deal with, you know, making sure students have the correct accommodations or technology or whatever it might be.
Yeah.
So one of the other additional hats that you've been wearing the past couple of years is about education policy. I know that you worked with Teach Plus and Advanced Illinois. Can you tell me a little bit about that?
Sure. Yeah. It's actually kind of a great segue, because we were talking about IEPs, and there's one group I'm working with, and we're trying to streamline IEPs a bit.
How so?
There's nothing set in stone, but we are working with a little small group with somebody in the legislature and through ISB and all that, and different stakeholders. And every year the IEPs get larger and larger and larger. And it's become almost like I would say like a Rube Goldberg machine, if you know what that is. It's like really complicated.
Right. We've got 19 different levers to drop a ball down, you know, like that type
of thing. Exactly. Yeah. All this stuff. And they're so cumbersome that it does two negative effects. One is it makes it very burdensome on the teacher. You have all this work that just keeps getting larger and larger and larger every year. And in my opinion, a lot of the stuff there isn't really necessary. But that's, you know, we can definitely have debates over what's necessary and what's not. But also, like, from the parents' perspective, I can't tell you how many times I've gotten to a meeting where I'll send the draft IEP home and I'll ask the parents if they read it, and they're like, I know, like, I read like half the first page. It's, you know, 40 pages long, and they say, I tuned out. It's not very parent friendly when they see this giant document and they start reading it, and there's jargon, and it's, you know,
it's like doing your taxes.
Three pages into it. Yeah, you go 3 pages into it, and it's saying the same thing that it did, you know, 2 pages before, and it's so cumbersome that very few parents can access it, because it's very intimidating to them, and it doesn't really make sense to them. So the one group I'm in, we're trying to streamline that to make it more meaningful for families to understand it and to participate in the process. So that was one thing.
Why I'm curious, why do you think that happens when these things get more and more cumbersome and, you know, just more and more complicated?
I think everything's done with good intentions, definitely. Yeah. I think you may have had a parent whose child has had a bad experience with something. So they say, well, you know, this should be improved. And so they'll talk to the legislature. I'm not exactly sure how this works exactly, but maybe they talk to the legislator, and the legislature says, oh, you know, like to make sure this doesn't happen again, we should add this to the IEP. And it's something that nobody can really disagree with. But it then becomes like the straw that broke the camel's back. It's like, well, yeah, how can you argue with this little point here? No, we can't. So they'll pass it. And then another thing comes along. Well, how can we argue against this? It's going to help the kid. Okay. And then so many things that it's overwhelming.
It's kind of similar to something that happens with education policy a lot, where the state legislator will be like, we want to pass this new unit of instruction in this class. We want to add this, you know, whether it be, you know, a certain type of history or something like that. And everyone's like, that seems like a great idea. Yes. And then we're like, well, wait a minute, guys, we only have a certain amount of hours in the school day. And also we keep passing things that say we're going to do a brand new unit of instruction on S or on X. But no one actually knows what a unit of instruction is. That's not like a technical term. And so we kind of have to interpret that however we think. But again, like, well-intentioned things, but we aren't necessarily thinking about what the implementation is going to actually look like over the course of a school day, or how a parent's going to interact with this form in reality.
Right. So that's one thing I'm doing. I also have been affiliated with a couple of different policy groups. So I got into policy in 2019, when a colleague of mine told me about a group called Teach Plus. And that is a group that recognizes that teachers are an important part of the process. So they had a fellowship, and I was a member of the 2019-2020 cohort, and it was great. We met in Springfield or Bloomington, and we meet other people who are like-minded, and we learn about how to write op-eds. We've learned how to have meetings with different legislators.
Just basically learning on how to advocate for policy.
Exactly. Yeah. And then we like even learned how to write different things. We researched it and we presented. My subgroup was examining SEL, social emotional learning.
Mm-hmm.
And ours never got published, but it was fine because it was still a great learning process. And I did a lot of great networking. And when that fellowship was over, I liked policy so much that I talked to the person, Josh Kaufman, who's the head of Illinois Teach Plus. And I said, are there opportunities to kind of go further with policy, even though my fellowship has ended? And he told me about Advance Illinois, which is another one that does policy work. But it's a lot more, it's a lot bigger than Teach Plus. Teach Plus really focuses on teachers. This has stakeholders who are teachers, college professors, administrators. So they have a teacher pipeline group that examines the pipeline, the people who are coming into the teaching profession and how we can bolster that. And I've been with that for like 5 years. And it's just fascinating. Every month we have a meeting and I learn something new every time. We meet with different stakeholders. And I really come to the conclusion that we don't really have a teacher shortage per se. We always hear that teacher shortage. The fact is, I say it's calling it a teacher shortage is like saying that we have a food shortage. Like, do we have a food shortage in America? Well, no. Like, I've got to exercise to burn off all the extra food that I eat. Like, we have more food than we eat. We throw away food in our refrigerator. The problem is, you know, some people are very wealthy and can eat free range grass, you know, grass fed beef or whatever. They can go out to eat every meal they want. Most of us get enough that we want. And then some people are chronically hungry. They don't know where their next meal is coming from. And that's kind of like the teacher shortage issue, is that some districts get hundreds of applicants for every position. They get people coming in from other districts to try to go to their district because it pays more. Most school districts can get by. And then some districts don't know where their next teacher is coming from. Like, they have students scheduled for classes that they don't have a teacher for yet. So the issue isn't that the pipeline isn't working. Like, we produce a lot of graduates with degrees in education. The problem is that the pipeline is not hooked up to a sprinkler. Like, they're not going where they need to go.
It's also been a misconception that I've been trying to talk about on the show. We've talked about it for years now, right? Like you said, this is something that if you want to be a high school English teacher, you're a teacher in Crystal Lake, I'm sure we're getting a few applicants on there. You know what I mean? Like, I'm sure that's probably pretty fine. But it's that there are specific school districts and there are also specific content areas where these shortages are actually happening. Like, in, you know, if you want to be, again, in maybe a more rural area, a school psychologist, or teach in, you know, English as a second language, or even science and things like that. Like, those are the places where those shortages actually exist. I mean, like, even in a, you know, kind of rural community around where I grew up, I know that they went through a couple of years recently where they had no, like, high school, I think, chemistry teacher. And so they had to just do it like an online module and try to figure it out for a year or two. And, you know, sometimes those rural communities are also sharing resources. So you hope that there's a school district within 15 miles of you, so a teacher in the middle of the day can drive from one school to the other to try to fill those areas. It's a really fascinating problem. And I know that it's something that you've been looking at too, about like what potential solutions could be for like how we get those teachers who are coming out of the pipeline to the places that they need to go. I know that like grow your own programs have gotten a lot of attention over the last couple of years where, you know, students who are at a specific school, you know, they have an interest in being a teacher. We can bring them back after college, or, you know, they're a paraprofessional who's working in the district and maybe we can get them into a position, help them get a degree or a credential. It's like, I'm familiar a little bit with those, you know, potential solutions. Are there any other things that you've learned about how we can get the food to the people who need the food, to prolong the analogy?
Yeah, those are some great ideas that people are implementing, and it's helping. One major thing is just how we fund schools in Illinois is it's so disproportionate because we're so heavily reliant on local property taxes. But since we started evidence-based funding, I think that was
2017.
About then. It's gotten a lot better. And so that's helping, I think, that schools are starting to have more resources to be able to track teachers to their districts. So that's one thing. And until it's fully funded, we should see slow progress, but that's going to be one of the biggest things. I think what we have to do is kind of target things specifically. So young people go into college and maybe they had a great history teacher and they had a great experience with that. So they said, I'm going to be a history teacher. And then they go to college and the college is happy to take their money and you know, have them go through the process and they get out with a degree and they can't find a job anywhere near where they would like to live. So they go into another profession. I think we need to be very like transparent with folks who are going into the profession. A lot of times I'll speak with substitute teachers. We have some great substitute teachers in my district now. I'll speak with them. A lot of them are going to school to become teachers. And when I hear the ones that are going into math or science, I'm like, oh, that's good. That's really good. And when I hear the ones who are going into social studies or English, I'll say, are you coaching now? Are you doing this? Like, are you doing other things to help you stand out to other candidates? Because I don't think a lot of people really understand that the shortage isn't equally distributed in all areas and in all subjects. So I think that transparently is very important. So people know what the odds are of them getting a job in their field. Not saying that they won't be able to, but how are you going to make yourself much more attractive to an employer if you are like focused on only doing history in a suburban school?
Yeah. Do you sometimes tell them too, like, well, are you interested in teaching at a smaller rural school? Are you interested in teaching at maybe a lower income urban school? Because they could really use your help if you really do want to go into this.
Yeah. Consider it. You know, just think about it.
Yeah.
A good solution is just being more transparent. I think we could also do things like just being specific with our funding. So we'll have, you know, scholarships for people to study education, which is great, but really targeted to those areas of highest need. So maybe scholarships for people who are going to be in special education or going to rural or urban districts, it would be good. Right now, I did a study for Advanced Illinois last year. I'm on the Educators Advisory Council, and we do a project each term. And the one I did last year was on school psychologists.
Another perfect segue. I was just about to ask about it.
Yeah. So yeah, perfect here. And I actually first became interested in that because my son graduated from college with a degree in psychology a year ago in May. And being the good dad that I was, I thought, oh, what can I do to kind of help my son look for different jobs? Because he didn't want to be like a psychologist. He loved psychology, but he didn't want to be a psychologist. So I thought, oh, maybe school psychology. So I looked into it, and it's so hard to become a school psychologist that I'm kind of surprised that the shortage isn't larger than it already is. As it turns out, my son would not be a good school psychologist candidate. He's a very analytical person, but would be work real, real good with the kids in schools. But besides that, it got me looking at this more and more. And so obviously, it hits rural schools especially hard, even more than urban schools. Especially co-ops has a really high shortage rate. But first of all, it's very hard to get into the programs. All the public schools have extremely low acceptance rates. The public schools are the ones that are affordable. Oh, yeah, very, very low acceptance because they're only a handful of providers. I think maybe like 6 or 7 universities in Illinois, public ones, offer it. Now, there are a few private ones, and those tend to have higher acceptance rates, but they're really expensive. If you look at the provider level, when I spoke with administrators, they said that these programs, they're pretty expensive to run because they're very resource-consuming, several-year process to go through it. There's a lot of supervision they have to do. So they're not cash cows for the universities at all. Northern actually has a program that takes teachers who are interested in becoming school psychologists from these certain targeted districts who have chronic shortages. And they allow those teachers to take classes at night, because that's the other thing is with a lot of these programs, if you get into them, you're going to school full time. A lot of people, they can't afford to just quit their jobs to go to school for a couple of years and then go back to getting a paycheck. But the Northern program allows teachers to take class at night. They allow them to do their internship at the school where they're at, and then they'll be certified after that. It's extremely popular. I think that's a model that we should, as a state, encourage. Maybe we can encourage other universities to have a similar program and really target funds to programs like that.
I'm glad you brought up the NIU example too. And I think in general, we're at a really complicated place with that, because I think that everyone recognizes that student mental health is like one of the biggest priorities. And again, I think that just I mentioned that a new Advanced Illinois report, one of the things that it outlines is that student mental health challenges is basically all of those student well-being indicators are headed in the wrong direction, have been headed in the wrong direction for a while. So at once we recognize that there is a big need for school support staff and like school psychologists, but we know how difficult it can be to actually get people in those roles. And then to kind of exacerbate that, we had at the federal level a bunch of canceled federal grants that were specifically dealt with school-based mental health services that, you know, there were a bunch here in Illinois that got canceled. And actually, you know, I know that NIU had a grant program as well. There was a five-year project that they were like 2 years into to prepare educators, you know, to be school psychologists. There was also one of them that was, you know, targeted for termination by the federal government. So like, it's something that at once, like, everyone, I think, fundamentally understands is a big problem and is something that needs to be addressed, but also you see that there isn't always people pushing in the same direction to solve those problems, which makes things very difficult.
Yeah, and in this program, it's so successful. They have, the person I spoke with said, they have people calling up constantly who aren't in one of these identified districts, and they'll say, hey, I heard about this program, can I join? And they said, no, you can't, because you're not affiliated with one of these school districts. But we'll take your name down in case we ever open it up more. There's just such demand for it. So it really seems that it's that bottleneck of, we have people who want to become school psychologists, and we have this program that's helping them to be school psychologists, but how do we actually help them through that bottleneck so that they become school psychologists?
Yeah. Do you feel like having maybe, even though you were tuned into this stuff prior to doing the actual policy work, that now kind of being a bigger part of this process over the last couple of years, do you feel like it helps you as a just teacher day to day to feel like you have a more broad-based understanding of education policy in the state?
Yeah, definitely. And I have an administrative license, but I've never gone into administration. And one thing is I just really like doing what I do. And I really respect our administrators, because I think that's kind of their calling in life, is be administrators, and they're very good at what they do.
Yeah.
But I think mine is being a teacher. And when I'm with these policy groups, I have a perspective of a teacher. So I have a few perspectives. I'm a teacher. I'm somebody who's a career changer. I'm somebody who was a parent of a student. I'm somebody who has an administrative license. So I have all these kind of perspectives together, and I think they really helped me. So when we look at things like getting people into the profession, I was one of those people who was working at a facility. I liked working there, but the pay was really low, and I was looking for a way to advance my career. But I'm thinking, like, how am I going to quit working to student teach? I can't, like, because I was married and I had a 3-year-old at home, and thought, how am I going to support all this? It was extremely difficult. I ended up working from Saturday night to Sunday, like nonstop. I did overnight shifts, and my mom and my mother-in-law did a lot of babysitting for us. That was very helpful. But I remember thinking, like, I can't do this. There's no way that I'll be able to do that. So I kind of had the perspective of a lot of other people who are in similar situations. We're trying to attract people to the profession. You have a lot of people who are thinking, like, I can't quit to student teach, or I can't afford to take classes at night, all these different things. So I think that's been really beneficial, to have my own perspective that I can apply to policy.
Yeah, I think it was just 1 or 2 years ago that we made it to where student teachers have to actually get paid for the work they do.
Well, no, actually, they still don't have to get paid. There's a bill that was in the process last year to pay student teachers, but it didn't pass. The bill that I think that you're thinking of allows student teachers to get paid. So
it's just that they weren't allowed at all.
Yeah. So before, like, no teachers ever got paid. Now it's the district, if they want to, they could. And I think some districts are doing that because they're saying, hey, well, if they student teach with us, then maybe we can keep them on as a teacher after they graduate. Or maybe they already work at the school and they're like, hey, well, this would be great for them to stay at the school, so we'll offer them that incentive to stay there.
One of the questions we always like to ask everyone, Bob, is about the teachers who've inspired you. And you can answer this question in a variety of different ways. It could be teachers that you had when you were a student growing up. It could be teachers who you work with now who inspire you just day to day. But I'm curious. I'm sure there's a lot of names that come to mind. But who are some of the first ones that you're thinking of?
Well, I'm going to talk about a couple. And not just, you know, a couple like as in two. I mean, an actual couple.
Oh,
these teachers. So I had, her name at the time was Miss Fadden. She was my ninth grade algebra teacher, which is funny because that's what I teach. I teach ninth grade algebra right now. So Miss Fadden, and the same year I had Mr. Schaefer for biology. And a couple years later, they got married and they're still married and they're grandparents and everything. That was a real transitional time for me going from junior high to high school. I grew a lot and I was not a top student. But they gave me a lot of room to grow. I especially remember Miss Fadden's class. We were horrible to her. Like we were so mean in that class. It was just a lot of rambunctious kids in there. And I remember I was one of the nicer kids, and even I was pretty bad to her. And she just handled it with such grace, and she put up, but she's like still believed in me, you know. She still had these high standards that she would not let it go, you know. She just stuck with it, and I eventually found her on Facebook a couple of years ago and apologized to her, and she said, "You're not the first person from that class to apologize to me."
We were like, "I guess that's a good thing, but it's also a bad thing so many people felt like they needed to."
Bad, yeah. And then her husband, Mr. Schaefer, was my biology teacher, and he would, I remember I was failing it, and he would say, "Hey, come to my office. I'll tutor you before school." So my dad would drop me off. It was still dark out, and I would meet Mr. Schaefer in his office every day before school, and he just tutored me every single day. And he didn't have to do that. There's nothing in his contract that says you have to be there to, you know, before your contract time to tutor kids, but he did every single day. And I remember taking a test in his office one-on-one with him, and I did it, and he had his calculator, and he was punching the grades, and he goes, "That brings you to," and I'm just like, you know, sweating bullets on this, and he goes, "A D minus, congratulations, you passed." Now, that was one of the crowning achievements of my life, was passing ninth grade biology. I would not have been able to do it without him. So that really motivates me now, is I got to pay it forward, you know, or pay it back, I guess, is I look at these kids now, and if they're going to put in the effort, I'm going to be there for them. If they did poorly, but they want to change things, then they want to turn things around, and they want to do a retake, and they want to meet with me for tutoring during a planning period or before or after school, I'm going to be there for them. So Mr. Schaefer is a guy who really put that teacher work ethic in me.
That's really cool. Do you feel like that's something that you appreciated in the moment, or is that something that you feel like crystallizes more and more for you as you are now doing this yourself?
Well, with Mrs. Schaefer, I appreciate now because I'm on the other side where I really, wow, she really put up with a lot. And if the kids are ever naughty with me, I think, well, I was the same way to her. So this is kind of payback for how I was.
Yeah.
With Mr. Schaefer, it was in the moment. I was like, oh gosh, I really appreciate what he's doing for me, because I'd really screwed up by not paying attention earlier. But between him and my dad just drilling me, I still remember the classification system. It's Dominion, Kingdom, Phylum, Class, Order, Family, Genus, Species. I can just rattle it off because of ninth grade, just Mr. Schaefer and my dad just drilling that into me.
That's that D minus, baby.
That's right. Yeah. Monera, Protista, Fungi, Plantae, Animalia. Still remember that.
There you go. See that, that's growth, right? Like that's the story of, just turning it around, trying and improving. That's all we can ask for, right?
Right. That's right.
I've only got a few more questions for you, Bob, and we can kind of, you know, go a little bit more rapid fire through some of these so I can get you out of here. I don't want to take up your entire afternoon, your entire evening here. One thing that's just fascinating that you got to do, and I couldn't go through this interview without asking you at least once, which is that you recently visited every single Illinois county, which is, I believe, it's 102 counties?
Yep. And I have the selfies to prove it.
Yeah, so you took a selfie at every single, you know, like, entrance into the county where you got the sign in the background there. I just have to ask, A, what made you want to do it? And B, what did you learn from doing it?
So why I wanted to do it is I'm a map nerd. My poor wife has had to put up with my eccentricities over the years. I actually have a Rand McNally atlas by my bed because I like to look at maps all the time.
You and me and both. Me and my brother are all, you could just find us sitting on the couch with a map.
We are kindred spirits.
Yeah.
And I was looking at all the counties and I thought, you know, how could somebody do this? I live in the far northern part of the state. And I thought, would you like do a circle around like the edge for, you know, and then like kind of concentric circles to get them all? Or would you start by going deep into southern Illinois and kind of crisscross?
Right.
I'm not sure how you do it.
And because you're not, even if you've been to these counties before, you still have to go again because you still have to get the selfie, right? So it's not just like, oh,
exactly.
You know, I live in, you know, McHenry County or whatever it is. That doesn't count. You still have to get to the sign.
Right. Yeah. People can't take my word for it. I got to have proof of it.
Yeah.
So, because it's a claim that so many people want to make is that they've been to every county in Illinois, right? But when I was playing this out, I quickly realized that not all places where they have a county border sign is a safe place to pull over. I was going to go to one, I think it was in Henry County, and the place to pull over, I looked at, I was driving by, I'm like, no way, that is not a safe place. So I found a website that specifically has a county lines, because Google Maps doesn't really have the county lines for places, but this,
right.
This one
let
website
alone
did,
like
so
the
would,
sign for the county line.
Yeah. So I would find exactly where the border was, and I would, at home, I did a lot of research to be able to find out what the safest border crossing was in each of these counties. And some of them were pretty difficult. There's like one I had to go to the side of a bridge to get on.
How many signs do they even have for county entrances? Like two or three?
Yeah, usually about that. So okay. Not every row that goes in and out of a county has a sign. Like the interstates do, but those aren't safe. the state highways do. Those are usually where you get them. Like little, like, you know, subdivision roads, obviously, they don't have those. So there are a lot of farm areas where I'd pull over, and I'm also kind of shy, and I pull over. I didn't want anybody to look at me and think, what the heck is this guy doing, taking a picture in front of the sign here? So I would also try to find areas where there weren't a lot of houses so I could have the possibility of people seeing me do that. But it was so much fun. It was like, I liken it to Pokemon Go for adults. You know, I just find this, it's like a scavenger hunt. I so much fun.
Yeah, if there was a little like badge that you unlocked on an app every single time, that would be great. But the selfie kind of is basically that.
Yeah. And I would really get off the beaten path. And that's kind of goes into the second part of what I learned is, if you travel for one place through the interstate, just the fastest way, you'll get there, but you won't really learn or see anything along the way. I had these goals of getting to these border crossings, which are pretty remote places. And along the way, I would find pretty interesting things. And I would research the places before I go, and I'd learn. And Illinois has a pretty interesting history. I think every state does it if you research it enough. But I learned that, like, the world's heaviest man, the world's tallest man are both from Illinois. So Robert Wadlow, who was the tallest man, is from Alton, and there's a statue of him there.
Yeah.
And Robert Earl Hughes was the world's heaviest man for a long time. In fact, he still holds the record being the heaviest man who could walk on his own 2 feet. And he was from Illinois, the same area. They lived maybe like less than 100 miles away from each other, and they're actually pen pals. They lived at the same time. I learned that the Scopes trial, which you may have learned from history class, was the also known as the Scopes monkey trial, which is about evolution in Tennessee, I think in the 1920s, I believe. And John Scopes, who was the teacher in the case, is from a small town in Southern Illinois. What's more interesting than that is the prosecutor in that case, William Jennings Bryan, is also from the same town. Their houses were like a mile away from each other. And actually, William Jennings Bryan was the commencement speaker at John Scopes High School graduation.
Oh.
Yeah.
And so you learned that through the process too.
Yeah, yeah. So this trial of the century at the time, both people involved in it were from the same town in Illinois. Here's a story of how one thing led to another. I learned about a thing. It's called the Windsor Goat Tower. And there's this couple in Windsor, Illinois, which is southern part. And they built a tower on their farm that mountain goats can climb and they live in. It's like these apartments for goats.
Oh, I love
that.
I
met with them. Yeah, they were fascinating. In fact, the wife is a retired English teacher. And the husband is
here on Teacher's Lounge.
I know exactly. Yeah. Yeah. He was at one time a principal, and then he felt he wasn't really getting support. The schools weren't really getting supportive in the community. So he got out of that and went into crop insurance. Yeah, very fascinating people. They would be great guests actually for the show. So they told me about this. I got to see the goat tower. I got to see the goats. And then they said, well, why are you in this area? What else did you want to do? And they recommended that I visit this covered bridge because it was, it's not abandoned. I mean, it's just not used anymore. This is covered bridge because they built a road around it. But for a long time, they would, up until I think the 70s, I'm not quite sure when they did. It was in use for a long time. So I visited this covered bridge on that same day, and there is this other guy there. I thought it was kind of unusual because this was way in the middle of nowhere. I mean, it was very, very remote. And I got to talking to the guy, and inside the bridge, there was a lot of graffiti, like all over the place. Yeah, it looked like every high school kid who'd ever been in the county put their names on there. And I said to the guy, this bridge would be so much beautiful if it weren't for all the graffiti. And he goes, yeah, I'm trying to find my name in here. And what it was in I think the late 60s or early 70s, he was one of the kids. He scratched his name, his initials in there, and he was trying to find it. So I kind of insulted the guy in a way. I felt pretty bad. But you know, I just randomly met this guy, and he's telling me about the area. And he says, he showed me on the bridge, there are these scratch marks, these horizontal lines that actually went back from to when they had wagons, being before cars.
Oh, no
like
kidding.
This
right.
bridge is so old, it's from I think the 1860s or 1870s.
Right.
That there's actually permanent scratches from wagons going through. Well, that was just so fascinating. This guy, and he's telling me his life story and about the whole area.
Do you know if other people have done this? Have other people documented visiting every single county who's not like running for governor?
Yeah. I don't know about doing the selfies on things, but there is actually a club of people who have been to every single county in the United States.
Oh, that's
of all 50 states.
That might be too much for me, but I feel like you should.
That's extreme. Yeah.
I feel like you should at least get like a medallion from the governor or something, you know?
I think so. Yeah. Yeah. Can you put a good word in for me?
I'll see what I can do. But one of the other things I was thinking is I was like, well, what would be a good Bob project? And then I was like, well, there are 852 school districts in Illinois.
Yes.
Maybe that's next.
In each one of those districts is how many schools, right?
Exactly, yeah. But that could be a fun – there would be some really cool just architecture, really cool school locations.
Definitely.
It would be a heavy lift and, again, a lot of traveling, and you'd have to figure out how you're going to zigzag your way through the state. But I was like, that's – maybe I should do that one.
Yeah.
All right. Well, I don't have too much for you. I want to, again, not take up too much of your time. But the last two questions we always like to ask people, one of them is just we can do one of them that's more specific to special education and one that's more broad to teaching in general. With the broad one, what's just something about teaching you wish more people knew?
So I've had a lot of teachers myself in my life, K through 12, then college. And I'd say, you know, I've had a few teachers who probably should have made a different career decision. But overall, when I look at a lot of the teachers I've had in my life and a lot of the teachers that I work with right now, I have some really dedicated colleagues. I don't mean just teachers. I mean, teachers, support staff, administration. There are just so many people who are really good at what they do. And they just work so hard to help the students grow.
That's something that we say a lot, too, about how, you know, people say, you know, there's so many people who care so much. But I think that it's cool to hear you go the extra step further. It's not just that they care about it. It's that they're also really good at it.
Right.
And then, same token, what's something about special education you just wish more people knew?
I would say special education. There are a lot of people in our general society who they'll have feelings for people with very visible disabilities, and they'll they're kind-hearted toward them, and but they don't always realize that disabilities are a very broad category. There are some very accomplished people who have disabilities. Probably my grandfather may have had a learning disability. He did not do well in school, and he actually dropped out and hitchhiked around the country. Then he joined the Marines for World War II, and he thought he was dumb, and he wasn't. He was actually a brilliant man, but he thought that because he didn't do well in school that he wasn't smart. So I guess I would say that a disability isn't like a defining thing. It's not who you are. It's just an aspect of who you are. A long time ago, I learned, so this is in the 90s, I had an education class where the teacher said, try to put the disability first. So trying to say like a learning disabled person, because that's not the most important thing about a person. You say a person with a learning disability, because they are a person. They're a whole person with a lot of things going on. And that's just one thing about them. Now the listeners on the radio can't see me, but I wear glasses. That's just one thing about me. It's not like the most defining thing about me is, oh, there's that guy who wears the glasses. Like, yeah, I do, but that's only one thing about me. And so I think when we think about people with disabilities, it's a very broad category, and it's not something that limits a person. It's just only one aspect of who they are.
That was my conversation with Bob Chicos, special education teacher at Crystal Lake Central High School. Thank you so much for listening to Teacher's Lounge. As always, please feel free to nominate a teacher in your life to be on the show. It's how we get all of our great guests like Bob. Please send them our way to teacherslounge@niu.edu. Wherever you're hearing this podcast, please subscribe, leave us a rating, share it with a friend. If you like what we do here, it is really the best way to get even more perspectives on the show, even more teachers onto the program. A big thank you, of course, to the Northern Illinois band Kind Ofs for the music you hear each and every episode of this show. And I have been your host, Peter Mudlin, and we will be back with more Teacher's Lounge very soon. See ya.